change, but not our love of gold. Music gold, for sure. And the vault is full on the Old Gold Show. Classic and time-tested hits. Take that nostalgic trip with us on Thursdays at noon on 88.7 KRVS. I'm Lee Kleinpeter. And I thank
you. On the next Hearts of Space, a journey from catharsis to inspiration, with music by Lisa Gerard and Jeff Rona, Eleni Kara-Indru, Arvo Pärt, Valentin Silvestrov, and Carl Jenkins. A program called Translucent Music on the next Hearts of Space.
Coming up Wednesday night at 11, right here on KRVS.
You are listening to KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
Hello and welcome to Bayou de Beltway. Today we are joined with author Jack McGuire to talk about politics in Louisiana, specifically Earl Long. Mr. McGuire was born in New Orleans. He went to Newman High School. He went to Tulane University, where he got a double major, political science and history. And then he worked for New Orleans Mayor Victor Shiro from 64 to 70. He had a number of important positions there. Since that time, he has mostly worked as a vice president for Union Savings and Loan, with the exception of some time he took to be a four-time elected city council person in Mandeville. This is his third book. He has written two other books, Rulers, Rascals, Reformers, The Governors of Louisiana, and Uncle Earl Deserved Better. This third book, the one we're going to discuss today, is called Win the Race or Die Trying, Uncle Earl's Last Hurrah. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Earl Long's last race, which you cover in this book, was a titanic struggle between Harold McSween and Earl Long for the 8th Congressional District seat. McSween won in the primary, but in the end was beaten in the runoff. It was a runoff that saw Earl Long staggering to the end and then dying a few days later, leaving McSween in the position that they had fought for. I think McSween eventually took that position. What did that last hurrah mean to Earl Long, and why did you decide to write about it?
I think that Earl Long, who said politics was his life and he intended to be in it until the day that he died, after the turbulent events of the 1959 session of the legislature, when he collapsed before the legislature after delivering two rants that were sometimes vulgar while he was trying to preserve black voting rights by stopping voter purges by the white citizens' councils. Then his wife had him first committed to a mental facility in Texas, and when she agreed to let him come home, then had him committed again to Southeast Louisiana Hospital in Mandeville. So by the time this had occurred, and he'd been in and out of two mental hospitals, he devised the strategy himself that secured his release in both occasions. And the manner in which he did this is probably one of the best evidences of the fact that he was not crazy, as was claimed and as the media portrayed him. He ran for lieutenant governor and he lost, finishing third, and everyone wrote him off as politically finished. No future. The turbulent events of 1959 had been an embarrassment to him. He had lost the race for lieutenant governor, and he then wanted to have a redemption. I always had the view, and I followed him up there. He wasn't so much running for Congress as he was running for redemption. He went to the old Long home ground in the 8th Congressional District in north central Louisiana. He ran against Harold McSween, the incumbent. And I think that he was really intent on going out a winner. While there's no question in my mind that he viewed the congressional election as a warm-up for running for governor again in 1964, I think he also recognized that his health was failing and that this campaign was going to be one that would be just really difficult. The title of the book, Win the Race or Die Trying, comes from the fact that in the several days before the runoff election, a cousin of his urged him to take the last two or three days off and relax. And he said, "Ed, I can't do that." He said, "I'm going to win this race or die trying." He said, "I would rather win it and die than lose it and live." And that was truly that campaign, with his health failing. He had still had a weakened heart from a major attack in 1950. He had lost a great deal of weight, but he was making 8-10 stump speeches a day. He was driving himself relentlessly on this, and he was intent on winning it or die trying, and he did both. He won it in the runoff, and he died 9 days later.
He died trying. Let's talk a little bit about the way he campaigned, if we could. So when you say he made 8 or 10 stump speeches, now, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me in your book what you described was that he would get up really early, get out in the pea patch, start doing a whole bunch of stuff, and then he would get some supplies and get his driver and get in the car, and then he'd head down the road, stopping at roadside stands and buying things and nursing a bottle of liquor. Is all that stuff true? Did he do that stuff? How does that work?
A substantial part of it, is true. In that campaign, he literally ran a road show. One politician up there said it was like the circus coming to town. And Uncle Earl would have a group of fellows with him. He'd have two or three station wagons with speakers mounted on top and a record turntable in. And they would start off the day by him sending the sound trucks and his advance men ahead of him. And he would have speakers, legislators, old retainers, warm up the crowd with telling them what a great man Uncle Earl was. He had two bands traveling with him. One was gospel. The other was rockabilly.
Can't argue with that.
No, he would arrive when the advanced speakers were finishing. He would take the stump, literally a standing microphone in the back of a pickup truck, and the other speakers would all go ahead to warm up the next crowd. He frequently was running late, but people would wait for him. And one of his drivers then, a fellow named Ellis Littleton, who'd left school in third grade and was like a son to Earl and was worked around the farm, but was his driver for most of that campaign, would tell me how they would do a lot of different things. They'd stop, as you said, at these country stores. He loved to get luncheon meat and Vienna sausage and cheese and crackers and sit around. He'd visit with people. If someone admired the big, wide-brimmed white hat, straw hat that he would wear, he would insist on signing the inside of it and giving it to him. They were very proud to get Uncle Earl's hat, not knowing there were a dozen more in the trunk of the car for the next time someone admired his hat. But he had a bucket full of quarters so that he could give a quarter to kids who approached him. He had another bucket of red soda pop, which he liked, a bottle of Seagram's 7 Crown, Cokes, and a couple of mixers. And then he usually traveled with a box full of cheese, crackers, and cans of Vienna sausage. But it was really a caravan of vehicles and speakers with him, and it was probably really the last stump campaign of that type.
Let's talk about that just a little bit. So this is a real old-style Southern campaign you're talking about, coming into town, loudspeakers, alerting the crowd that somebody's coming, gathering a crowd, getting up on the back of a pickup truck, delivering the speech, passing out hams and different kinds of things that he liked to do, and then heading on to the next town, right? And do you think that – has anyone done that kind of campaign since? Now, that would have been in 1959 he was doing
well, 59 for Lieutenant Governor, 1960 for Congress.
So has anyone done that since in Louisiana?
There probably have been some in succeeding years, but not on that scale. McKithen and his two elections did a pretty good job of stumping the state, but I don't think he brought to it that same kind of excitement that Uncle Earl did, and no one matched Uncle Earl on the stump in his invective against his opponents and his enemies. The closest later was Edwin Edwards did a caravan that traversed the state, but it was all motorhomes and set appearances. So
let's talk about his invective just a little bit, if we can. There are a number of marvelous stories. So tell me about him calling his opponents names. He liked to characterize his opponents. He's kind of a little like Don Trump with Crooked Hillary and all that, you know. So when he got up on the stump, what made Earl really special on the stump?
Well, he was very colorful on the stump. He had that raspy voice almost.
As a result of an accident
in
his childhood?
He swallowed some lye when he was a child. He would always be raising his arms, tugging his suspenders, always laughing and smiling because he really enjoyed the give and take of a political campaign. He loved going after his opponents. He called Harold McSween Catfish Mouth McSween. The only time Harold ever been over was to pick up his golf ball. He's got gold-plated fixtures in his mansion in Alexandria. He said McSween, who he sometimes called McShane, but most of the time Catfish Mouth, was the only person he knew who could sing a song, whistle a tune, smoke a cigarette, and have his hand behind his back for a payoff at the same time. He called other opponents. He said he's smooth as a peeled onion. Another one, he's a wife beater, and he's got diabetes, too. He said he's going to jail. He's going to jail. There's no doubt he's going to jail. He sold out, the people of this state. Uncle Earl's going to take care of him. And he said, they want to make this tough. He said, get this. I invented rock and sock'em politics.
Amazing. Now, this sounds a little bit like his older brother, Huey. So tell me, what's the difference between Earl and Huey Long?
Earl actually was very important to Huey's political career. When Huey ran for the Railroad Commission in 1918, Earl worked actively for him. And in 1924, when Huey lost for governor but finished a strong third, and Huey was elected in 1928. And Earl was appointed to a position that was actually a lucrative one in New Orleans by Huey, collector for the inheritance tax collections of Orleans Parish, which paid very good fees. So Earl spent most of his time in Baton Rouge, and particularly at the legislature. I think that if he did not devise the idea of the round robin to prevent Huey Long's conviction on impeachment, he certainly helped line up the votes on it. Huey once said, I bought that guy like a sack of potatoes. Earl said, I'm not like Huey. I didn't have to buy them. I just rent them for when I need them. But he and Huey broke in 1932 when Earl wanted to run for governor, lieutenant governor, and Huey refused to do so. Huey claimed that he felt that the public would think there were too many Longs in public office if he supported Earl. But actually, Huey knew that Earl would be totally independent and that he wouldn't be able to control him, and Huey wanted a governor and state administration he could control.
Wow. Well, that's certainly a lot. We are talking today with author Jack McGuire, who's had a long career, some of it in politics, but he's written a book on Earl Long, and we're talking about that book. We're going to talk some more when we come back.
You can skip the hassle of finding a buyer for that unwanted car. Just donate it to KRVS and turn it into a tax deduction. Or maybe you've got a truck or a boat or an RV you don't want anymore. Donate it to KRVS. It's very easy, and it helps to support KRVS. A toll-free number and link to the vehicle donation page is on our website, krvs.org, or simply call 877-KRVS-887.
Bring the peanut butter because I'm bringing the jam on the Zydeco Stomp. I'm Herman Fuselier reminding you that every Saturday it's you and me till 3 with the best in Zydeco blues and old school R&B on KRVS. The music's so good you want to get on your telephone and call somebody and tell them I'm jamming with the Zydeco Stomp. Noon Saturdays only on KRVS. Lafayette, Lake Charles. Et toi, mon clé pasha.
Welcome back to Bayou de Beltway. We're talking today with author Jack McGuire about his most recent book, Win the Race or Die Trying, Uncle Earl's Last Hurrah. When we left our conversation just a moment ago, we were talking about some differences between Earl and Huey. Earl wasn't a political organization man, much like Huey, in the sense of building machine. Does this kind of sum up some of the major differences? Does that stand for some differences between the two?
That was certainly one of the differences between the two. While Huey's organization was not the type of political machine you think of in major American cities or in some states, it was more or less an alliance of courthouse crowds, minor politicians and others, but Huey enforced discipline on it. And that was the difference between Huey and Earl. One of Earl's leaders said, we were like the old feudal system. Earl Long was the top lord, but all the others were lords in their own bailiwicks, in their own areas. And Earl, in effect, would put together what amounted to a coalition of interests each time he ran. And what's significant, and this is a difference between Huey and Earl, although Huey's career, of course, was much shorter between 1928 and 1935 when he was assassinated, Earl recognized that someone who was with him in one election may be against him in the other, and it would depend upon what the interest of the individual at the same time were. So with rare exceptions, he didn't make these lasting difficulties and differences. For example, in 1940, he narrowly lost the runoff for governor in his first bid for a full term to Sam Jones because another candidate, Jimmy Noe from Monroe, who had been one of Huey Long's closest confidants, state senator, ran as what he called the true Long candidate, accused Earl Long of being involved in the Louisiana scandals of 1939-40, which saw the governor and president of LSU and many other political figures go to jail. And so while Earl felt that he had lost the election then only by a few thousand votes. It was about 51% to 49% because no supported Jones in the runoff in return for half of the state patronage. In 1959, Earl talked no to come out of retirement and had the ticket for Noe for governor and Earl Long for lieutenant governor in 1959. Now, Earl's motive then was also that Noe was a very wealthy oil man, owner of radio and TV stations, and he expected Noe to finance the campaign. So I think with Earl, it was alliances of convenience. One of the other differences between him and Huey, people who were close to and knew both well, generally said that Huey was not nearly as warm a person as Earl. He didn't like to be touched. Huey inspired fear rather than love among even those closest to him. Whereas people loved Earl, they would hug him. You know, they thought he was just a good old boy. Huey, after his election as governor in 1928, returned to Winfield, to the long family homestead area only a couple of times. Earl loved his farm there, the Peapatch Farm, returned to it every weekend that he could, and was very proud of his watermelon crop and his cattle and his billy goats. And he was most comfortable there, and he would drive into town to get the papers in the morning wearing his long johns and his pickup truck.
You know, I rarely get an opportunity to do this, but I have to point out that Niccolo Machiavelli, the famous political theorist, said about the love-fear nexus that it's good to be loved by your people, but in fact it's better to be feared. Because they're more likely to do what you say. I want to go back and talk specifically about civil rights and Earl. I know that his famous breakdown, took place in the context of some legislation about civil rights. He was prominent. In one of his speeches, he said, and I'm quoting, "I'm 1,000,000% for segregation, but I want the colored people to be happy. But that doesn't mean we have to shack up with them." What was Earl's position with black voters, with blacks voting, and in relation to segregationists like Willie Reinach? Is it Reinach?
Yes, Reinach.
And Leander Perez.
Yes. Well, when Huey was in Huey's time, there were only 1,000 black voters on the rolls in Louisiana. It began to grow. The poll tax was repealed. But by 1948, when Earl took office for his first full term, he encouraged black voter registration. And by 1952, when he left office, there were about 140,000 black registrants. And by 1956, when he came back into office for a second full term, there were about 160. This was still a small part of the voting population. And while the state was about one-third black then, only one-third of those blacks were actually registered to vote. Huey and Earl's program of long-night benefits had always been based upon raising the poor people. And blacks came along with whites in that, in everything but segregation, with the school hot lunches, veterans pensions, the old age pension that Earl put in 1948. And he equalized the pay of school teachers. Until Earl took office in 1948, black school teachers were paid lesser amounts for the same duties as white school teachers. But by 1956, when he returned for his final four term, segregation had not been an issue in that campaign. They were all for segregation. But by 1958, when it was plain that the Supreme Court intended the Brown versus Board of Education decision to be implemented and that federal district judges throughout the South were going to do so, the White Citizens Council movement in Louisiana came to the fore. And it was led by Senator Willie Reinach of Summerfield and Claiborne Parish, Representative John Garrett, who had taken Willie's House seat when Willie went to the Senate, Judge Leander Perez of Plaquemines and St. Bernard Parish.
And their governor there that they elected, Jimmy Davis, in 1960, and he, of course, was kind of a staunch segregationist.
Absolutely. He beat Morrison, Mayor Morrison of New Orleans, in a runoff on a strict white supremacy campaign. Earl had always enjoyed very strong black support. And the citizens' councils, they formed the Association of White Citizens' Councils of Louisiana in a very cynical approach to it. Reinach and Garrett and Perez accepted the fact that they were just fighting a delaying action against school integration, that they would eventually lose this. So they determined the way they would still hold the line on advancements of blacks in Louisiana was by, as Reinach put it, cleansing the registration rolls. And in 1958, they began purges of blacks from the registration rolls in 10 North Louisiana parishes and moved to some others. And that procedure was, state law at the time provided that any two voters could challenge the registration of another voter, and they could have him stricken from the rolls if he made any error in his registration card, whether he didn't dot an I, sign his name properly, put a period, And they went through this and purged 31,000 blacks from the voting rolls.
This is pretty amazing. You know, listening to this in this time, it's just so blatantly racist and un-American to purge, you know, voters from the rolls. But his Earl's breakdown, I mean, he was really, in some sense, came unhinged on this issue. Tell me about his famous breakdown. Now, he's speaking before Judiciary Committee B, as I recall, on May 26th. What's the story of that speech? What led to it? And was he crazy? I mean, was he bipolar? What went on? A doctor said he was a paranoid schizophrenic in need of hospitalization.
Yeah, and that was the type of diagnosis that was routinely used by coroners throughout the state to put someone in for observation. By early 1959, Earl thought he was the only person who could see Louisiana safely through the school integration crisis. And he had floated the idea that he would resign as governor before the next election, and then Lieutenant Governor Fraser would become governor, and he would be running as Fraser's successor. He did give that idea up. He'd started smoking heavily again. He'd stopped after a 1950 heart attack. He'd always been a social drinker. Now he was drinking more frequently. Frequently, he would have a Coke bottle in his hand that either had grape juice and vodka or half bourbon, half Coke. He wasn't sleeping well. He was disturbed because the Internal Revenue Service was investigating 4 years of his taxes, and his wife was building a home on the Capitol Lake in Baton Rouge for them on what was then called Millionaire's Row, is now Ted Dunham Avenue. And he said this was going to embarrass him with all of the people throughout the rural areas who'd supported him, that he'd always campaigned out of that shack of his in Winfield, and now they would think he'd gone high hat on them. So all of this came as a confluence. He wasn't sleeping well. He was taking uppers and downers. And when the legislature convened in May of 1959, he gave an address to the joint session in which he said what you just did, that he didn't intend to belittle or chastise the colored people. He appeared before a House committee meeting on May 16th in behalf of bills he intended to introduce to liberalize the voter registration laws and to grandfather in anyone who had been registered for 1 year. And at that meeting of the committee, he was taunted by members of the White Citizens Council, by Raynack and Garrett, and one of his most incredible responses to the hate and clamor that was going on, he pointed to Willie Raynack and he said, when this is all over, when this all ends, and we know how it's going to end, you're going to go home to your house, to your place in Summerfield on the pond there. You're going to, I want you to go up there and I want you to take off your shoes and socks. I want you to get in your rocking chair on the porch. I want you to put your feet up in the railing. And he said, Willie Raynack, I want you to look at the moon, commune with your God, and then maybe you will understand that Negroes are humans too, and they have just as much right to vote as you and I do. And that's when, you know, they felt, I mean, here yeah. In the midst of the integration crisis was a Southern governor calling for black voting rights to be preserved. That's when they thought he went crazy.
What they probably didn't realize, he didn't realize, was that you couldn't be an integrationist governor through that period and stay in office or stay in power. Of course, Raynack went up there, took off his shoes, looked up to the moon, and then blew his brains out.
Yes, he did. He committed suicide a few years later.
Well, we're just about to head out. We have a couple of seconds left. We've been talking today with author Jack McGuire on Win the Race or Die Trying, Uncle Earl's Last Hurrah. That book is out now. It's on University of Mississippi Press, I believe.
Yes.
And it's available. I certainly encourage you to get it. It's a stunning read. Thanks so much for coming to the show.
Be delighted to be here and to be with you. I appreciate the invitation to come.
Bayou to Beltway is copyrighted by KRVS for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without written consent of KRVS is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of KRVS, its officers, or members. To listen to a podcast of the interview we just heard, go to krvs.org.
You are listening to KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette Lake Charles, online at krvs.org.